Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses reaction in the Muslim world to the U.S. bombing campaign against Afghanistan, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit, who proclaims his opposition to the war in Afghanistan and argues for a thorough examination of U.S. foreign policy to strike at the roots of terrorism, and author and columnist Nat Hentoff, who asks citizens to oppose a coup d'etat against the Bill of Rights that he and other civil libertarians fear has been underway since the September 11th terror attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The U.S. began airstrikes against Afghanistan on October 7th, and most Americans would expect that the U.S. intelligence community has a working knowledge of the region and its political factions. However, as reported in The Atlantic Online, ex-CIA agent Ruel Marc Gerecht says nothing could be further from the truth. Mr. Gerecht explains some of the reasons why the CIA has found it difficult to penetrate extremist sects or recruit their members. There are precious few individuals with an in-depth knowledge of Islamic culture, let alone any individuals willing to give up years of their lives in deep cover. Quoting a Near East Division officer, Gerecht writes, "The CIA probably doesn't have a single truly qualified Arabic-speaking officer of Middle Eastern background who can play a believable Muslim fundamentalist who would volunteer to spend years of his life with substandard food and no women in the mountains of Afghanistan. Most case officers live a comfortable life in the suburbs of Virginia." Another handicap for the CIA is a fear of leaving the westernized embassy at Islamabad. Operatives are warned about going out and mixing with the natives. It is Gerecht's opinion that given the U.S. intelligence agency's limitations in the Middle East, a belief in the imminent destruction of Islamic terrorist groups is only self-delusion. While U.S. forces have launched attacks on the Taliban regime and on Osama bin Laden's terror camps in Afghanistan, fertile ground for producing terrorists are the so-called moderate Arab states that for decades have relied upon U.S. military protection. According to the New Statesman magazine, 13 of the identified suicide hijackers were citizens of Saudi Arabia, and others came from Egypt. Apparently, bin Laden's support network included former Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki bin Faisal al-Assad, who was fired in August for failing to stop attacks against U.S. troops in Riyadh. Today, few outsiders understand the Saudi kingdom and its influence on hardline Islamic movements like the Taliban. Most Saudis follow a state religion called Wahhabi, an ultra-puritanical strain of Islam promoted by the Saudi royal family, the national government, the Saudi army, and the bin Laden family, which controls one of the biggest construction empires in the Persian Gulf region. Since the 1980s, rich Saudis have bankrolled the religious schools in Pakistan, the madrasas, which trained the Taliban leadership and fueled hatred of outsiders. As the New Statesman concludes, these schools left a deep mark on the young boys who later took Kabul. 10 years after the United Nations helped broker a ceasefire over the dispute in North Africa between Morocco and the West Saharan Polisario rebel movement, the international body is retreating on its promise of self-determination. For a generation, the UN supported self-determination for the Sahrawi people after Moroccan troops invaded the former Spanish colony in 1975. In recent years, thousands of people have been expelled by the Moroccan government, and over 160,000 Saharan natives were forced into desert refugee camps. According to the New Internationalist magazine, through the 1990s, the UN supported a public referendum for the region, similar to the one carried out in East Timor in 1999. The UN appointed James Baker, the former American Secretary of State, as an envoy to settle the West Sahara conflict. And in 1997, Baker helped reach an agreement on the tough issues of voter registration and repatriation of refugees in preparation for a referendum. But now all those plans are on hold. Baker is now pushing for autonomy for the West Sahara, a plan strongly backed by the Moroccan government. Despite objections from nations like Russia, Ireland, and Bangladesh, the UN Security Council has endorsed the move toward autonomy talks. In response, Sahrawi refugees have renewed the call to armed struggle to win independence. Many UN observers believe that Baker changed course on the West Sahara out of a desire by the Bush administration to bolster the standing of Moroccan King Mohammed VI, a trusted American ally. Supporters of West Sahara independence are angry, saying the UN has betrayed one of its core principles, the promotion of self-determination of all peoples. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Fraser and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
The U.S. war against Afghanistan began on October 7th, with bombers and missiles striking military and infrastructure targets as part of an American-led effort to destroy Osama bin Laden's terror network and topple the Taliban government. Although the Pentagon and State Department said they were doing all they could to avoid what they describe as collateral damage, Taliban officials told the international press that 4 United Nations workers and 20 civilians had been killed in the first 2 days of U.S. attacks. Reactions to the airstrikes were seen across the Islamic world in angry street protests in many nations, including Pakistan, Egypt, Jordan, Oman, and in the Gaza Strip. Pakistani President Musharraf, who reluctantly endorsed the American war against Osama bin Laden and his former Taliban allies, was apparently nervous about many of his own citizens' opposition to the U.S. assault when he urged a quick end to the fighting on October 8th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses reaction in the Muslim world to the U.S. bombing campaign and the possible repercussions for governments supporting the U.S. war against terrorism.
Among some minority elements, there is what you would call sympathy for Osama bin Laden. But I think among a much broader swath of public opinion across the Middle East and the Muslim world, there is sympathy for the country of Afghanistan and the idea that the country and its people are sort of caught in the crossfire of a war between the United States and the Taliban and bin Laden. Of course, bin Laden's militia are not Afghans. Very few of them are Afghans, and they're a foreign presence on Afghan soil. The Taliban are not exactly a popular government there. The fear would be that many Afghans, whether they're being displaced outside the country, made refugees by the threat of military action and now the reality of military action, or whether they're displaced internally inside Afghanistan out of population centers into the countryside where they have to forage for food. My great concern, and I'm sure the great concern of people across the Arab world and Muslim world today, is that those people will become innocent civilian casualties in this war.
Would you go on to talk about the vulnerability of regimes in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and elsewhere to unrest and backlash to their alliance with the United States against the Taliban government in this current campaign?
Sure. I think the government which has most to fear from this unfolding crisis is Pakistan. General Musharraf, the general who led a military coup there 2 years ago, was visibly nervous when he went on Pakistani TV to talk about the fact that, yes, American missiles and airplanes had gone through Pakistani airspace before striking the targets in Afghanistan. There were scattered riots, disturbances in Pakistani towns close to the Afghan border, the area where there are many Islamic schools or madrasas, which are sympathetic, some of them, to theologians there, to the variety of Islam espoused by the Taliban. And later in the day, there were much, much larger demonstrations in several Pakistani cities, which were violently repressed by the Pakistani police. Several people were injured. So certainly Pakistan, the government there, is quite worried, as evidenced by their harsh response, that protests there will take on an explicitly political character and will be directed eventually more toward the Pakistani regime than towards the United States. There were demonstrations elsewhere in the Middle East. There was even a small anti-war demonstration in the Sultanate of Oman in the Arabian Peninsula, which is a place where it's extremely rare that there would be any popular protest whatsoever. There were protests in the Gaza Strip and occupied Palestinian territories and some protests elsewhere in the region.
As many listeners know, Pakistan is a nation that possesses nuclear weapons. And the fact that many people are saying that the military government there is vulnerable to a backlash, and the fact that General Musharraf has reassigned some top generals who were sympathetic to the Taliban. But I would ask you, is there any remote possibility that Pakistan's government could fall and that Islamic extremists could come into possession of Pakistan's small nuclear arsenal?
I suppose that's a possibility. You know, certainly one can imagine a scenario where that would become more likely. I would say that's probably an alarmist scenario right now. If there were to be a large ground invasion of Afghanistan that went into root out the Taliban, and if those people fled across the border into Pakistan, and U.S. troops pursued them into Pakistan, there's a possibility that a Vietnam scenario might develop where the war would actually spill over into Pakistan, and then you know, anything would be possible. I think probably right now that's probably an alarmist scenario, but it's certainly very worrisome that not only Pakistan but also its neighbor India has nuclear weapons. And India is watching the unfolding situation with great trepidation as well. Of course, there's already a conflict raging between Pakistan and India and Kashmir, and that's a conflict which in which there is some participation by Islamic extremists who are affiliated in some way with the Taliban and perhaps with bin Laden. And so this is all linked. And it's, you know, certainly possible that there could be some spillover that could escalate into something quite dangerous.
That was Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. Contact the magazine by calling area code 202-233-3677 or visit their website at www.merip.org. The American public, according to opinion polls, was squarely behind President Bush's decision to launch a U.S. air war against Osama bin Laden and the Taliban government of Afghanistan, which is sheltering him. Ever since the September 11th terror attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the public has rallied behind the president and his tough talk about declaring an open-ended war against the evildoers who took the lives of some 6,000 innocent civilians in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. But on college campuses across the country, and even on the streets of New York City, just a few blocks from Ground Zero, tens of thousands of citizens are questioning the launch of a new war to fight terror. Protests organized by college students and veteran peace activists condemn the terrorists while resisting calls for war, which many fear will lead to an ever more deadly spiral of violence. Some in the anti-war movement also argue that our nation must now ask the difficult question, why so many people, particularly in the Muslim world, hate America. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Catholic Bishop Thomas Gumbelton of Detroit. Gumbelton, who has been an outspoken critic of UN economic sanctions against Iraq, proclaims his opposition to the war in Afghanistan and argues for a thorough examination of U.S. foreign policy to strike at the roots of terrorism.
History has shown one thing that seems true beyond doubt, and that is that violence never resolves violence. Violence only brings more violence. And so I do not understand how our responding with violence is going to bring peace. There will be a spiral of violence that will go on now, and that's borne out, in fact, by our own leaders who are warning us to be prepared for the next attack. And they're saying it could be even worse. It could be a germ attack. It could be a nuclear attack. So what are we doing by going to war, by responding with violence, if we expect this is going to result in a counterattack again?
There are many in the peace movement across this country that agree with you, of course. They say, as you say, that we should confront terrorism through diplomacy and international law. But according to polls, the majority of American citizens assert that this is naive and unworkable and that you have to fight fire with fire, so to speak. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, if we're fighting fire with fire, where does it end? Gandhi said it so well. It's, you know, that if you believe and follow on the practice of an eye for an eye, you'll only end up with a world where everybody is blind. And so if we keep on doing violence and respond to violence, the violence escalates. And each time it's going to become worse. And back in 1963, Pope John the 23rd, made a statement which, again, I think is prophetic. He said, in our atomic era, it's irrational any longer to think of war as an apt means to vindicate violated rights. You can't think of war anymore as appropriate, even to vindicate violated rights, because we're in a new period of history, the atomic era. Somehow, we seem to have forgotten that we have methods of destruction now that surpass anything that has ever been developed in human history. And so our whole planet becomes at stake and is threatened. And yet people say, keep doing it. Well, where will it end? Dr. King said, it's no longer violence or nonviolence, it's nonviolence or nonexistence. And that's the situation we're in historically. And yet somehow we seem to ignore that. We seem to think we can just go on as though you have wars like they were fought in the past. Now war means the destruction mostly of civilian lives and very often of children. And then there's no limit to the amount of destruction that can be done. And when people say that we're unrealistic, I say, well, what's realistic about our Secretary of Defense telling us that we're going to war to end terrorism, but then telling us at the same time, be prepared for the next attack? And the next attack might be germ warfare, might be nuclear. Why is that accepted as being realistic, not being insane, as well as being immoral? So I just don't understand people saying that we're the people who are unreal and idealistic and so on.
Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, I know you've given this some thought. If you were in a position to make some decisions about how the U.S. would have responded to the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington, what would you do?
I think the first thing I'd do, and it would not be difficult, is to ask our government leaders to begin to probe the reasons why people hate us. Why would anybody be so angry and have such hatred and resentment toward us as a nation? And it doesn't take a lot to find out why when you begin to look at the record of U.S. foreign policy over the last 50 years, where we have intervened in one situation after another, we have overthrown governments, and we have left behind, again, a trail of anger and hatred and resentment. You can go back to 1953 when the CIA overthrew the Mossadegh government in Iran, put in the Shah. The Shah was in power then until 1979, when finally the anger and the resentment there erupted in attack against the United States Embassy, and then Iran becoming very hostile to us as a nation when they overthrew the Shah, who was a tyrant and who was oppressing the majority of the people of that country. And they blamed the United States because we, in fact, had put him in power, had supported him. He was our friend from 1953 to 1979. And we did the same thing in Guatemala in 1954. We overthrew a legitimately elected government, put in a military government and dictatorial government. For four decades, the people of Guatemala suffered under various military regimes supported by the United States. We have paid for dictators and tyrants all over the world through our military support. I remember 1980, Archbishop Romero pleading with President Carter, don't send any more arms to Guatemala or to El Salvador. Those arms that you send down there are being used to kill the poor. And he himself was shot to death by someone trained in the U.S. and probably with a U.S. weapon 5 weeks later. And yet, most of us in this country have just forgotten about all of that. And that's what we need to be remembering. That's what our leaders need to remember, and all of us need to remember.
That was Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit, Michigan. Just one day after the U.S. military began bombing Afghanistan, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge was sworn in as the nation's first director of Homeland Security. President Bush created the cabinet-level position shortly after the September 11th terror attacks in New York City and Washington. As head of the new office, Ridge will coordinate the work of 46 agencies to both prevent future attacks and respond in the event terrorists strike again. Public fears were raised about new terror assaults with the news that two Florida men had been exposed to anthrax, resulting in the death of one. With growing concern about security, a majority of Americans polled supported the imposition of a national ID card and new anti-terror laws proposed by Attorney General John Ashcroft. Legislation now making its way through Congress includes proposals that would expand government authority to detain immigrants, initiate roving telephone wiretaps, and monitor suspects' electronic communications without a search warrant. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Nat Hentoff, who warns that despite their concern about safety, Americans should oppose a coup d'etat against the Bill of Rights that he and other civil libertarians fear has been underway since the September 11th terror attacks.
Both John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, who has very dim notion of what civil liberties are, and the President, who as Governor of Texas showed even dimmer knowledge of civil liberties, and the proposal that Ashcroft, via the President, or including the President, has submitted to Congress, is dangerous, just plain dangerous. There has been, I'm glad to say, some resistance in Congress, particularly in the House. You've had people who have never agreed before on much of anything, let's say Maxine Waters and Barney Frank on one side, and Army and Bob Barr on the other, although Bob Barr, though much maligned as a conservative, is probably the best civil libertarian in the House. But even what they've done, it's not nearly enough to save these bills from having, I think, very, very severe consequences. And the major problem is that most Americans, and this is what the White House counts on, what Ashcroft counts on, are very ignorant of their own rights and liberties. This is taught so badly in the schools that every poll we've seen so far has made it clear that 70% at least or more of Americans are willing to give up their liberties in this time of, and it is a time of danger and insecurity with regard to national security. But if they don't know their own liberties, they won't know very much about what they're giving up, and therefore they'll be indifferent to what other people are giving up. Now, both bills have, as Ashcroft wanted, have rather vague descriptions of what terrorism is. But included in that language is support of terrorism. What does support mean? Suppose you gave a contribution to an organization that you thought was engaged in humanitarian activities, as it was. It was also doing some radical stuff. Thereby, you were under suspicion.
Nat Hentoff, there is a mood in the country, as you spoke of, where people are willing to give away their civil liberties if it ensures their security.
Yeah.
Many of the measures proposed by the Bush administration and Attorney General Ashcroft are okay with the public by and large if they're targeted to terrorists. But what is the history of this country in terms of abuse of some of these eavesdropping, wiretapping, and other...
You can go back to 1798, only, 7 years after the Bill of Rights was adopted. And the John Adams administration put in the Alien and Sedition Acts, which said, and they put editors, reporters, and civilians, if you like, into prison for 2 years until Jefferson stopped all of this. All you had to do was criticize the president and Congress. Then we had, in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. That's our oldest English-speaking right. It means that if you're put in prison, you have a right under the Constitution. It's in the Constitution itself before the Bill of Rights, to go to a court and say, hey, you got to justify putting me in prison. That was over. And Lincoln, by the way, also imprisoned editors and reporters who opposed his principles. In the First World War, Woodrow Wilson practically obliterated the First Amendment. The labor leader, Eugene Debs, a socialist and a, a very prominent figure in American history, was put in federal prison because he gave a speech saying that you don't have to go to the draft if conscientiously you oppose this war. Then we had the Red Scare in 1919 and the early 1920s, when the Attorney General then, A. Mitchell Palmer, with his bright young assistant named J. Edgar Hoover, rounded up in 33 cities thousands of so-called subversives, Bolsheviks, dangerous aliens. He deported summarily, without any due process at all, hundreds of them. Then we had Joe McCarthy. And I don't have to, I think, go into much detail about people who were lost their jobs because of their being suspected of being communists or communist sympathizers. Now, so far, we've been able to come back. The Constitution has come back into being, even after the one of the worst things the Supreme Court ever did, and that was the Japanese internment during the Second World War, where they took a whole group of people simply because of their ethnicity and put them in internment camps, which is a nice way of saying concentration camps. Finally, the Supreme Court never really overruled that, but some of the justices who did vote on it apologized later. But I'll tell you a significant thing. The present Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, in a book he wrote 3 years ago, said that if he had been on the bench back in the Second World War, he would have voted the same way to intern these people, just because of who they were and what they looked like. And he said if it came up again, he would again vote for that. So the thing to do is more people have to be aware of what's going on, protest to their congressmen. I mean, there are plenty of sit-ins now, and those sit-ins are focusing on, you know, whether we should go to war, whether we should kill people in return for having our people killed. Okay, I understand that. But much more vital is whether you're going to continue to be able to protest. And that's why I'd like to see more sit-ins about this kind of legislation and what can be done to protest it.
That was author and columnist Nat Hentoff. Read Hentoff's columns on the Internet by going to the Village Voice website at www.villagevoice.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Arch Curry, Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.